If you recall from last time, we were talking about our first lecture in this series on human factors. And we were talking about this kind of innate need of human beings to designate certain places for certain activities, for certain uses, and then to organize those in a way that would facilitate their life. Really, what we're talking about is function here. And at the end of that lecture, I ask you to tell me, 10 years from now, if you're buying a house, how important would this notion of designating and organizing uses be for you in making that choice of a house? And we had a really wide range of responses to that. So at the very top, people who thought this was a high priority, someone said, a house needs to be functional and logical in its design because designation of use will seep into every aspect of our lives. Whether we're aware of it or not, having an ordered, efficient flow from room to room is not only convenient, but space efficient and pleasing. And there are many people who saw it as a top priority, but maybe not the dominant priority. For instance, someone said, in a house I might buy 10 years from now, I think function will be crucial. A home should be a space that is a sanctuary for the family that inhabits it. Having a home that functions to fit your specific needs creates a place of balance and allows you to feel relaxed. Although there are many other factors to consider, I think a home's ability to fit your specific lifestyle should be the main one. Someone else says, function is a high priority, but not the only priority. I feel it's very important for a house to be organized and structured in a way that is useful. I feel that a house is too much of an investment to not be made functional. In the areas around the house, if the areas around the house are not situated in a practical way, they'll be avoided and therefore not used. Someone else says, while I do believe function is essential in a house in order to ensure harmony, some creativity and randomness is also crucial to the sense of adding interest to a house. By having something that is not practical, life is made more interesting. Someone else says, function is extremely important, but aesthetics also play an important role. It's similar to dating someone based purely on looks. For a while, it may be great because the physical attraction is there. But if they're a nightmare to be around and they don't work well with you, you're eventually going to get tired of them. Likewise, with a house, even if it looks good, if it's terrible to live in, eventually the space will tire you. But the aesthetics still matter for establishing interest. So I get it on this one. The guy still wants to date a hot-looking girl. I get that, okay? Although, there are limits. Okay, I get it. Someone else says, while I believe in function as a driver of form for architecture, I don't think it's the only option because functions of houses can change as the society and cultures change. Just as servants' quarters or back staircases are no longer necessary in a southern house, a function today may be no longer necessary in the immediate future. Someone else says, function is a high priority, but not the highest. Constructing and designing spaces with specific functions is the best way to get the most out of a space. The room matches exactly its purpose. However, designing with some more generic spaces allows for creativity from the owner or resident. Rooms can be adapted easily with changes in individual functional needs. And then finally, some people thought, this sucks. I mean, function, who cares? For example, someone said, I choose option 4. I personally think that paying too much attention to the function of a building can cause it to become worthless. I would rather believe that homes can be built anywhere and should focus on aesthetic qualities. So, wide range of perceptions there. We did talk about why we might be interested in function and designating and organizing uses. We talked about that it's a practical thing sometimes. We talked about it's a way of embedding certain cultural values or taboos in a society. We talked about the fact that it often is, there's a provocation for this because it's a way of claiming a space, and we'll talk a little more about that today. We also said, especially in our current era, we're very obsessed with time and efficiency and convenience, and this can be an important factor there. And then also now we have all these machines, and they tend to have tethered spots, and so we organize our functions around those designated machines, and that's all the more reason to create these relationships between functions. So today we're expanding on this notion a little bit. The last lecture might have been thinking about form follows function. How does the form of a building end up being a result of the function and the organization of that? And today we might be talking maybe even more about function follows form. How is it that the physical environment might, even at an unconscious level, really affect our behavior? How we think, how we operate, who we make friends with, how we form communities, what kind of relationships we have. And this is a whole sort of field that is generally called architectural determinism. To what extent does the physical environment determine behavior? Early in the semester, I brought up the quote from Winston Churchill, "We shape our buildings, thereafter our buildings shape us." So today we're really talking about that notion of our buildings shaping us. How do buildings shape us, or to what extent? So there's a history of this notion of architectural determinism, that goes back maybe 70, 80 years, and it's in sociology and anthropology and architectural studies. So there's a lot of research that's been done on this. And some of it kind of started with primate research, looking at animal behavior and how does the physical environment affect animal behavior. And there were three books that were published early on in this investigation. One of them is called The Naked Ape by Desmond Morris. And this was really looking at primates, chimpanzees, apes, and looking at how their behavior may be parallel to human behavior. This was a long time ago, and this was a kind of new idea that, oh my God, these are not just random animals out there doing their thing in the forest. They actually have communities. They have lifestyles. They have values. They have norms. They have societal goals. And so looking at the naked ape, this primate out there, and understanding maybe that has, because of our basis in primates in the evolutionary sense, is there something in the way they behave that we could learn from the way we behave? So that's really what that book was about. Then there was a follow-up book that was called The Territorial Imperative by a guy named Robert Ardrey. And this is really focusing then on what is it primates do to organize themselves into communities. And he talks about it as territoriality. They are designating certain spaces for certain groups to occupy. And that's really how they sort of made family groups, made clans, made tribes. But it was spatial. It was architectural, how they formed their communities. And then if one group of people invaded or impinged on the territory of another group of people, there was conflict that came out of that. So as long as you sort of stayed in your architectural boundaries, there was peace, and it was a way of kind of organizing and reducing conflict. Then a third book came out shortly after called On Aggression by Conrad Lorenz. And this one is overtly about how primates reduce aggression. And it's phenomenal. That book really just credits its architectural moves that reduce aggression. It is organizing yourself spatially. That's how you reduce aggression in primate clans, and that they seem to be really good at it. And then there's the kind of implication, well, if we were better at organizing ourselves to reduce conflict and reduce aggression, it could make us maybe more peaceful, both country to country or culture to culture or neighborhood to neighborhood or family to family. And when you think about this, a whole lot of the way we have organized our governments and our cities is in order to give this kind of territorial separation and organization of different groups. And oh my God, sometimes it's scary and sometimes it's cool, but especially these days, we're very, very territorial. There are certain neighborhoods that are for certain people. And if you're another kind of person, you might be subtly made to feel uncomfortable in that neighborhood. And in a certain way, you could say that's our way of reducing aggression. In another way, you could say that's a way of us not understanding each other because we separate ourselves so much. I heard an amazing BBC story where this reporter from the BBC is in the United States and looking around at different cities. And in her very snotty British accent, she's saying, I'm appalled at the degree to which different groups of people occupy different neighborhoods. And America is not a heterogeneous society. They have become very clan-like, very tribal, and they've designated certain neighborhoods and communities and so on to separate themselves. And I'm thinking, bullshit lady, you're from England. I know that London is the most segregated and sort of encapsulated city I've ever seen, where in London you will go to the Bengali neighborhood, which is very different from the Pakistani neighborhood, which is very different from the Indian neighborhood, all of those South Asian cultures. But boy, you cross that line, you know this is Bengali and this is Pakistani. And then there are separations by religions. This is the Hindu neighborhood and this is the Muslim neighborhood. And so we do this all over the world in our cultures today. So this was all, you know, kind of identified and talked about in these books 50 years ago. And then there were also very specific studies and books done on human behavior of this sort. There's a very interesting one called Social Pressures in Informal Groups. Social Pressures in Informal Groups. It's kind of a wacky name, but it really is talking about how do we subtly, socially organize ourselves into informal groups. And it was done by a guy named Kurt Festinger, and his partner was named, Leon Festinger, and his partner was Kurt Back. And they looked at some student housing, graduate student housing, married student housing, on the MIT campus. And this was after World War II, and there was a shortage of housing. And so they had brought in some barracks buildings, just army barracks, and they put them down on Briggs Field at MIT and organized them in a certain way, and then they moved people into them. And what Leon Festinger and Kurt Schachter were interested in was how do people figure out who their friends are? How do they form clans? How do they form communities? And so these buildings were long, skinny buildings. They had an outdoor corridor on one side, and then all the units, I think there were 6 units on the top floor and 6 units on the bottom floor. And in one direction was the MIT campus, and in the other direction was a part of Cambridge where nobody would ever go. So all roads led to the east. And there's just these long series of long, skinny buildings all stacked up like that, all everybody wanting to go east, and 2 stories, and that's what the community was physically. And so they asked people in the community, who are your friends? Who have you made friends with? These people came from all over the country. Most of them had been soldiers in the war. They were married. They were older than average undergraduate students. They're like maybe, 24, 25 years old that had to delay their education because of the war. So they're in these environments, and these guys are, you know, how do you figure out who your friends are? So they thought, well, one way will be that people will cluster geographically. They will make friends with the people who are from their part of the country. So all the Southerners who talk a certain way and have a certain cultural background, they'll all be buds. And the people from California, they'll all be buds. And the New Englanders, they'll all be buds. And so they're trying to figure out from these questionnaires and interviews, and, well, that turns out not to be true. Surprisingly, people did not cluster with people from the same geographical area. And then they thought, well, maybe they'll cluster with people in their same discipline. So if all the physics nerds are going to campus and, you know, having classes with other physics nerds, then they and their wives might, that might be an excuse for them to form friendships around their common love of physics or their common love of business or their common love of civil engineering or whatever. And so they tested that among with questionnaires, and no, that wasn't true. People did not tend to make friendships with the people who were in their discipline. The one thing that seemed to be the dominant determinant of friendship formation was where did you live in the complex, and that you tended to make friends with the people who lived immediately around you in the complex. And there were two issues they dealt with there. One was physical distance. In other words, I am very likely to know the person on the apartment next door to me that way, the person in the apartment next door to me that way, just physical distance. I'm more likely to know the people in my building than the people in the next building over, just physical distance. But the other thing is functional distance. So having to do with where my paths are. So the people who were on the end toward the campus, so that everybody walked along that corridor and then down the stair in front of their unit at that end, those people were super popular. Damn, they made friends really easily because everybody's functional path took them by their door. And so it was a combination of physical distance and functional distance that encouraged people through informal encounter to make friendships in this community. And it was actually quite uncanny when they mapped out where friendships were, that if you just mapped physical distance and functional distance, you pretty much got the correlation. The other thing that's very interesting is on the way to MIT, if you walk down that stair at the end, right at the bottom was the mailboxes. And the mailboxes back then, everybody got snail mail. So, and especially since they're from all over the country, mailbox is a big thing. The people who lived by the mailbox, oh my God, they had so many friends because people would come down there, they'd check their mail, they'd stand around, they'd go through their mail. You know, if you left your door open, you could have a chat, you know. And so those were the people who had the easiest task of finding friends. So this was all a study about, wow, the architectural environment has a lot to do with forming community. And then at the beginning of the semester, I mentioned there are all these other studies that came, you know, out of the same idea about elementary school kids in California, that they learn a whole lot better if they get natural light. The more natural light there is in the classroom, the higher the test score improvement in both math and reading. So that's not socialization, but it is behavior. I actually learn better in some environments than other environments. I mentioned also this guy who studied hospitals, and in some environments, the patients got better faster. They needed less pain medication for equal malady. They had shorter hospital stays. If, in fact, the environment they were healing in was more conducive to healing, in particular in that case, views and views of outdoor natural environments helped people to heal. All of these are this kind of sociology that has to do with, can we affect behavior? Can we even determine behavior by the way we design a physical environment? In the 1970s, there was a guy named Oscar Newman who published a book called Defensible Space. And he made the argument in that book that we can reduce crime by design of the physical environment. So, for example, if you have a, let's say, a low-income housing neighborhood, and you put the playground so that all of the units, their kitchen, has a window out to the playground. Then the mom or the dad that might be in the kitchen cooking or something like that, they have the ability to look out and see the kids playing on the playground. In those neighborhoods, the kids don't get in as much trouble. As a neighborhood where the playground is way far away and nobody can see it, or a high-rise neighborhood where the parents are living up on the 23rd floor and the playground is down below, then that 12 or 14-year-old kid who goes down and starts playing with their buddies, they freaking get in trouble. They know somehow nobody's looking out here. Nobody is surveilling this area. So it changes their behavior. And the same way with like theft. If your car is parked in an area that you can see out your window, the likelihood of theft is much, much, much less than if the car is parked somewhere that you can't see it. The thief knows, I'm not gonna steal that. I'm gonna take some other low-hanging fruit from some other neighborhood where it's not organized in such a way that there's surveillance of people's belongings. So he's making the argument you can reduce crime by the way you design the physical environment. By the mid-1970s, late 1970s, there gets to be this whole notion that we can solve all kinds of problems by designing the physical environment. And the federal government started this urban renewal program where you would go into a neighborhood and it was crime-ridden and sociologically challenged, and they would just tear down the whole neighborhood. And they would rebuild it in a way that would make a more healthy, good environment. And that happened all over the country. There were urban renewal projects in Austin, but there were tons of them in the northeastern cities. Now, unfortunately, a lot of those times when in a very idealistic way, they came in and they made this real transformation in kind of social engineering, it didn't work. I mean, all the research said it should work, but when they redid these environments and they moved these people who had been in a crime-ridden neighborhood and they moved them into this much more healthy environment, oh shit, they still have crime. Wow. So then there was a notion, oh well, that was all bullshit, it didn't work. And they stopped the urban renewal programs and so on. Now, all right, what do we do with that material? I would say there are two takeaways for me. One is, yes, it does make a difference, the physical environment in the behavior of people and in their lifestyles and their organization of communities. But can you have a one-to-one predictable result? If I design the environment this way, can I make you behave exactly like that? Probably not. It's not that one-to-one fit. It is an impact, but it's not hand in glove. It's not cause and effect. So I'm going to posit that there are three kinds of relationship between physical environment and behavior. And that if we think in those ways, we get a pretty accurate picture of that's the way architecture affects behavior. So the first of these is that I think there are, for any physical environment, there are what we call conforming uses. Conforming uses. These are the things that was designed for specifically. And there's a pretty good chance that those things are going to happen in that environment in pretty much that way. So if you make a bathroom, it's very, very likely that someone will go in that stall and take a crap. That's going to happen. That's a conforming use. It was designed for that purpose, and that's pretty predictably going to happen. Then there are what we might call implied uses. This is not necessarily set in stone. It's something that just, by the nature of the way it's designed, it implies that those things might happen. And we'll talk about how that works in a few minutes. And then the third thing is there also are accommodated uses. There are things that can happen, maybe not predicted, not even considered by the designer, but just by the way that environment is designed, certain things are accommodated. So let me give you a few examples. Let's think for a moment of the very most deterministic physical environment one could make, the very most limited deterministic environment. And I'm going to posit that for me, that would be a coffin. So when you design that physical environment of the coffin, it's a pretty restrictive, pretty specific physical environment. What is its conforming use? Conforming use is to bury dead people. And its size and its shape and its materials, its entire character is built around that conforming use. What height, what depth, what width, it's going to be buried in the ground, resistance to water, all of those kinds of things. There are certain conforming uses. Then there also are maybe some implied uses. So there are plenty of times in a horror movie where a coffin is brought out and it isn't actually going to have somebody buried in it, but there's a certain kind of mystery and a kind of intrigue and a kind of spookiness that we associate with death and burial that then is attached to that coffin, so that just bringing a coffin into a room gives a certain kind of scary, feeling. And that's an implied use. It can make you scared. It can make you uneasy. It can affect your psyche. So that's an implied use. That's not what you designed the coffin for, but it's kind of inherent in the way the coffin works. So that's an implied use. The third thing, an accommodated use. So when you think about a coffin, the length, the width, the depth, a coffin would make a perfectly good planter box. If you filled it with dirt, it's about the right depth for dirt for plants to grow. It's generally kind of waterproof, meant for the water not to come in, but also wouldn't let the water out. So it would make a perfectly good planter box that way. So you can imagine taking a coffin, putting it in your front yard, raising some geraniums, and it would function quite well. It would accommodate that use. Was it designed for that? No. Is it even implied in it? No. But its size and shape and materials and configuration accommodate that use. Let me give another example. So let's think for a minute about dormitory bathrooms. So most of you have experienced maybe some sort of dormitory bathroom. And in particular, I'm thinking of the kind that are like sometimes called gang bathrooms, not those prissy little ones where you have an apartment and you share it with your suite mates and they're like four of you. But I'm thinking of a dormitory bathroom where there might be 20 people who live on the hall and they're sharing a bathroom. So let's think of conforming uses. Obviously, it's designed very specifically for taking a crap, like I said, or urinals for the guys for peeing, or there's a sink, and that's for shaving, for putting on makeup, for washing your face, washing your hands. There's a shower. It's very specific materials and shapes and configurations for those conforming uses of hygiene and bathing and ablutions and those kinds of things. Then there are maybe some implied uses of that. If you have 20 college students that are about the same age, have a lot in common, and you put them in the same room doing rather mindless activities like shaving or putting on makeup, and they're in close proximity to each other. We're both standing at the mirror. You're shaving, I'm shaving every morning. It's probably likely that we'll say hello to each other. It's probably likely, it's implied, that we'll have some conversation. It'd be extremely awkward if we didn't. But just putting us in that architectural relationship implies that we're going to have some conversation. So it's implied that this becomes a kind of social center. Conversation happens. People get to know each other in that gang bathroom. That's an implied function. And then there are all kinds of accommodated functions that could happen in that bathroom. My freshman year, I lived in a dorm with a super long and skinny gang bathroom. So it had like sink, 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 and then it had urinal, 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 then it had toilet, 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 and then it had shower, shower, shower. Long, long, skinny thing with a walkway along that gave you access to all of those, but all of those lined up against a plumbing wall. Crazy-ass bathroom. So there were probably 40 guys, it was all male dormitory, that shared this bathroom. And so there were a couple of kind of crazy guys on the hall who started the third floor John Olympics. And there were athletic games that happened in this bathroom. So what you would do is you'd turn the showers out, and, you know, it's tile floor. Turn the showers out and get water on all this tile floor. Take the sinks and splash the water out on the floor. So this long kind of circulation path would all be covered with water. And then there were these various games for how you'd take three big steps and then slide on your bare ass as far as you could. And then we'd mark, okay, Joe could go this far. You know, Harry could go that far, and this was every Saturday or so, that go down the hall, we're having the Olympics. You know, we'd all go down the bathroom, hang on the sink, stand on the toilets, and watch people, see how far they can go on their bare ass down the bathroom floor. I mean, this is accommodated use, okay? This is not like planned into it, but the configuration of it, the materials, the access to water, it accommodated that use. Several lectures ago, I showed you Morrison Stiles College at Yale, this dormitory by Errol Saarinen. We looked at it for its masonry walls. I had friends that lived there when I was an undergraduate. And it's got a very interesting configuration where there's a stairwell that goes up, and on each floor there's a living room right on that stairwell. And then there's a series of bedrooms off the living room, and then there's a bathroom at the end. And all of that is meant to be a social unit, so that you share the stairwell, and then all your living rooms are together, so those people are constantly seeing each other as they go up and down the stair. And then the bedrooms are a little more private, and then finally the bathrooms are at the end. But in order to make it work efficiently in terms of fire stairs, there was a door in one bathroom that would give access to another bathroom that was the next in the string. So there would be bathroom, rooms, living room, stairwell, living room, rooms, bathroom, then bathroom, rooms, living room, stairwell. So it was a chain like that. Well, and they were just fire doors. They were meant for fire egress. You had a second way to get out of the building, to go through the bathrooms. But people realized after a while that they could disarm the alarm on that fire door, and that maybe they had a friend who lived in the suite next door. Why would I go down the stairwell, over the other way, up his stairwell, back through his living room? Why don't I just open the door between our bathrooms and we can communicate that way? So that happens a good bit in Morrison Stiles College. And then it happened, these where my friends lived, they're these two suites, kind of, they had a lot of people who got to be friends. They were only accessible through the bathroom. So they kept that bathroom door open, and they constantly were going back and forth there. And then at a certain point, they thought, well, we're all buddies. We'd like to socialize here. We need to have a party. Well, their living rooms were a long way apart. You couldn't have much of a party split between the suites' living rooms. And so they decided, what the hell, we'll just have the party in the bathroom. That's what we share. And the door opens between them. And so I went to this great party that was in this double bathroom in the middle of their two suites. And when you think about it, I mean, the music was fantastic. All those hard surfaces, the acoustics, the reverberation was great. There were plenty of places to sit around in there. There was access, bar, water, all that worked great. It was a really good party space. But that's accommodated function, okay? And it just makes the point that you don't design
tight, hand and glove fit. These are much looser. You design for conforming uses, you design for implied uses, and you design for accommodated uses. And if you think of function follows form in that way, it actually is the case that one can be fairly reliable in understanding the possibilities of the way a space might be used and the kind of behaviors it might provoke. Okay, let's look at a few examples here. The first example we're going to be looking at is one of my favorite buildings in the entire world, and it's a little bit of an odd building to have as your favorite building. I was actually there over the weekend. I was in Boston with my son and daughter-in-law, and we were walking around, and I just can't resist. Always, when I have an opportunity, I'm going to go by Baker House. I love this building. So I dragged my son and daughter-in-law, and we walked by Baker House, and it's in good shape. And, you know, it's like visiting an old friend. It's designed by Alvar Aalto, this guy on the left. He's a Finnish architect, and it was completed in 1949. Interestingly enough, this was done right after that study by Leon Festinger and Kurt Schachter at MIT. So those buildings they were studying were on Briggs Field, that playing field right here, but a little farther down. They were sort of down here, and there was the site for Baker House. So Alvar Aalto was very interested in this sociological aspect of architecture, very, very interested in it. And so he was able to benefit from the research that had been done immediately before by Festinger and Schachter. So the building was designed with these things very much in mind. It sits on the Charles River. Beautiful views across the river here to Boston and the skyline on the other side. Back this direction is the main entrance to MIT at 77 Mass Ave. There's a whole series of dormitories along this row here, so it was kind of completing that. But let's sort of think through here how this building got formed by this notion of architectural determinism. So there's the river you're seeing right there, the skyline of Boston on the other side, this long, wavy form. This is the dining room on the lower level, the living room on the upper level, outdoor terraces for people to spill out and enjoy that view in the outdoors there. The roof of that little pavilion, green roof on top, all these skylights that let a lot of natural light in, then these little electric lights that shine down and do two things. Once they give light at night, that's very much like this light during the day from the top, but they also create enough heat to melt the snow on the skylights so that, like I was there on Sunday, it snowed like crazy. That would be melted away in just, you know, half an hour or something, and it would allow the light to continue to go in there. Very clever device. Now, we are lucky that we have all these drawings that Aalto did and document the thinking through the whole process. So these are a series of 12 little drawings that were done to study how do we mass the building on the site. Not massing it according to climate completely, although that's an issue here, but massing it according also about how people would live in the building. So it starts out here. There's that long, skinny site. The south is on this side of the site, the north on that side, east here, west there. And this is where the view is. The view is to the south. That's fantastic. That's also where they have really good winter sun. And they want as much winter sun as they can possibly get in Boston. So he's massing up that potential distribution of the building, and then he's looking at pluses and minuses. What are the pros and what are the cons to this? And he's rating this according to light and view and privacy. And then he's tallying the number of units he's getting there. At first, the goal was 300 units on this site. So this one, he views terrible light because it doesn't maximize the south light. Terrible view, everybody's looking into each other. terrible privacy. Everybody's able to see in each other's windows. They have to keep their shades down all the time. So what if you sort of slid one up and one back, and now we're beginning to get some more diagonal views up and down the river. We're getting more south light there, a little more openness than here. And privacy's a little better. You're not looking into each other. What about if you had three instead of four? What about if you canted the walls so that they're looking a little more to the south and to the view? What about if you spread them apart and made three completely different kinds of towers? What about if you slid one way and one the other way? And he's always ranking them, the number, you know, what is the light, what is the view, what is the privacy, how many units can I get? Here's one where it's single-loaded, and all of the rooms look to the south, and it's fantastic view and fantastic light and fantastic privacy. The only problem is he doesn't get anywhere near the 300 units, so that's not good. So what if I bent it, got a larger perimeter on that south side? Yeah, I can maintain those pluses, but I'm still not up to my numbers. Well, what if I made it even more wiggly? What if I made it even more wiggly? Oops, now I'm beginning to get a little conflict of people looking into each other. Well, what if I shaped it a little more like this or like this? And that is eventually the shape it came to. Optimizing light and view and privacy, and trying to get his 300 units on the site. Then he begins to put it up in three dimensions and look at how he might develop it. Now he's actually getting a few more units by stretching it out flat on the south side here. He's looking in plan. We're coming from the campus in this direction. The major entry is here. Then there's a sequence of the living room and dining room that he's wanting to have that great view on the outside there, and looking where the music room and some of the other shared spaces might be, working through the plan, and eventually coming to this configuration. Now, this, to me, is just freaking genius in terms of understanding how college students might live in this building. So, for one thing, at MIT, people tend to live in the same dormitory for 4 years. Very different from UT, where people jump around like crickets. One housing, lots of different options while you're here. But at MIT, the idea is that you, whatever dorm you select as a freshman, you're going to stay there for 4 years. And of course, your needs change over those 4 years. You maybe need to make friends a lot your freshman year, but maybe as a senior, you've already kind of got your group that you work with, and maybe you're nerding it up doing your thesis, and you might have completely different lifestyle and needs. So this is meant to accommodate all of that. At first, there were 300 rooms here, and you could get all 300 rooms looking south to the view of the river, to the south light, and with good privacy. Then at the last minute, they came back and said, oh, we just did our financial numbers one more time, and now we need 360 rooms. So you have to add 60 rooms. And I was like, well, actually, it's super upset, Alvaralto. I've read the letters back and forth. And he was like, oh, shit. You know, this is all working so beautifully. Now you tell me, come on. And he was like, okay, we scrap it. We start all over. And people convinced him, no. See if we can accommodate it in the scheme you've got there. So he adds a few rooms back here and back here. Those are getting west light, which is actually very good in Boston because you want the sun. It's cold. You want the sun for most of the year. And they actually have a pretty good view sort of down those playing fields and down the river to the west side. So he added a few rooms here and got up to that 360 students, about 60 per floor. So dividing it into six floors, he thought that 60 people could kind of get to know each other pretty well. And that was a nice size community. So you break the 360 into six floors of 60 each. And then within that, the idea was that you didn't have all the freshmen on one floor and all the seniors on another floor. There actually was a little more vertical integration. Not completely, but it would at least be nice as a freshman to be able to know what the seniors looked like and what their lifestyle was like. And maybe you need some help with your, calculus class that that person took. And, you know, so that it would be good to have some vertical integration. So this is really, really planned out well. So all of these are freshman rooms, and they're triples. And so you would come, and MIT students come from all over the country. Most students, when they come, don't know anyone else at MIT. They're free-falling here. So they get in a room with two other people. So those are all triples, and they're freshman rooms. Then right nearby, there are sophomore rooms where there are two people per room. And they all share a bathroom here and a living room there. So this end of the building is about freshmen and sophomores, and with a shared bathroom and living room, and a little more privacy as you move up as a sophomore. And then there are three little upperclassmen rooms there, just for somebody who likes to, you know, play with the little kids. They might enjoy being in that context. So that hall is kind of defined by the fact that it kinks here, and there are about 25 or so, maybe 30 students on that hall. Then it turns into the more upperclassmen area of the floor, and that's all single rooms through here. And they have a living room, and they have a bathroom. And then there's another one that's more single rooms and a bathroom and a living room. And then there's this tiny little suite down here that's very kind of exclusive and private. So on a single floor, you've got all these different options. And each of them is defined by the kinks in the building and the sort of smaller mini communities that exist within that. And you know, it's worked that way for about 65 years, and this is still one of the most popular dorms on the campus. Although student lifestyles have changed enormously, it still is an incredibly popular dorm on the campus, and a very friendly, very great social life that exists in Baker House. So then off of each of those floors, there's access to this stair, and the stair kind of tumbles down the building, focused then on the entry that takes you back to the campus, but it means that you actually run into people from other floors. And it's not like a little windy stair where you don't see anybody. Once you get in that stair, if you're on the sixth floor and somebody's on the third floor, you don't see them. But this stair, because it tumbles down like that, when you walk in on the sixth floor, you can see somebody walk out on the third floor. And it's a little more friendly. You see somebody down there, you know, hey, Harry, wake up, wait up, I'll walk to the campus with you. And there's just that kind of informal encounter that happens on the stair. Also encourages people to take the stair rather than the elevator. There's beautiful light, nice views in those stairs that have windows all along there. And then as those converge, that's kind of the front door. That's where the mailboxes are. That's where the access to the living room and the dining room. There's a nice fireplace, a little area to sit there. It's, you know, just... So when you come down the stair, you come out into a living area that is where your friends might be, you know, hanging out before dinner is served or after dinner or waiting to meet a friend or whatever. So all of that is in this sort of focus of where the stair comes down. And then the social spaces are all concentrated then in that dining room and living room. It's got the primo views out to the river. There's this nice open well between the living room and dining room. There's a nice kind of, back when I was in school, they don't do this much now, but they had the dining room down below. People would eat in the dining room below. And then after dinner, almost everybody would go up to the living room and they served coffee up on the living room level and people would spill out on the terrace. And sometimes you'd have guests, you know, faculty members or something that came for dinner. And almost everybody hung out for 30 minutes or so after dinner and had coffee and, just enjoyed the view and the day there. So I studied Baker House pretty thoroughly when I was a graduate student at MIT. I had access to all of those papers and drawings. It was a really great opportunity to get in the head of Alvar Aalto and see what was shaping that building. Then I wrote an article on that, and that was part of my research in my early career. And then I came to UT to teach. And one day I'm in Gregory Gym, and I see this guy with a Baker House t-shirt. And they had a very distinctive T-shirt where Baker House was spelled out in the shape of the building. So that big wiggly shape, it had Baker House in block letters in that shape. So I recognized it immediately. And, struck up a conversation with this guy. Turns out he was he'd gone all the way through MIT, undergraduate and graduate in chemistry. And then he was doing a postdoc here at UT for a couple of years. So we got in conversation. I told him, I've done all this research on Baker House. And so he just lets me have it. I mean, he just starts his testimonial. He said, when I came to MIT, I was a super nerd. I was a smart kid in high school, but I was socially completely horrible. I mean, I was inept. I could not make friends. And pretty much didn't have friends in high school. But I was smart, so I did great, and I made good grades, and I got into MIT. And when I came here, I knew absolutely no one. And I just thought, I will never have friends here. I will just spend 4 years completely alone. I won't even have my family here. It's going to be tough, but I can do this. And that's what he thought his life would be at MIT. And then he moved into Baker House, and he moved into one of those triples right there. And for one thing, he was just horrified. Oh, my God, I have to, strip down to my underwear with another human being in the same room. I'll be embarrassed to death, my skinny little nerd body exposed. Very traumatic. I don't know these people. He's just very nervous about it. But he got in there, and the very first day he realized, oh my God, my two roommates are just like me. They also have a hard time making friends. They also are super smart. They also are panicked at what this new experience is going to be like. They're just like me. And so the three of them just immediately bonded with each other. And just like that, by that superposition of putting you where you cannot not know these people, you cannot isolate yourself. You're in the room, in your skivvies, almost naked, in front of these other two people. It breaks down barriers. You've got to get to know these people. And he did. And immediately he felt more comfortable at MIT. Okay, I can do this. There are some people here like me who I can relate to. And then across the hall, down the hall, there were these other freshmen. He found that, there were people he enjoyed getting to know as freshmen there. There were sophomores across the hall who had taken exactly the suite of courses he was taking as a freshman last year. And there was nothing they loved more than being the expert. I'm the big upperclassman who went through what all the shit you're going through right, a year ago, and I won. I killed the bear, and let me tell you how you're supposed to do it. So he could get to know the sophomores because they wanted to interact with the freshmen. They wanted to, be the big upperclassman. And then also he would then get to know some of the people down through here and through here. They would have floor parties. That's the biggest party space in the whole building. It's the biggest lounge. So if you have a floor party, you have it in their territory, and the upperclassmen come down, and they know girls at Wellesley or at, Simmons or one of the other women's colleges, and so they're doing fix-ups, and oh my God, he even got dates, which he never thought in his entire life that would happen. But there were, upperclassmen who knew people, and they had parties, and he said, I spent 4 years at MIT, and it was so amazing. It transformed who I was. I just became a different person. I realized I enjoyed social life. I wasn't so stupid. I wasn't so inept. I could relate to other people. I could even relate to girls, for God's sake. And I just made great friends, lasting friends, friends for my entire life, living on that floor in Baker House. And of course, he moved from freshman area to sophomore area, and then upperclassman area, and he lived on the fourth floor of Banker House the entire 4 years. So I'm having this conversation in Gregory Gym, and I said, look, dude, you have got to come talk to my class. I can tell them this story, but it would be so much more powerful if you told them this story. So would you come to my class and tell us exactly what you just said to me? So he thought, class of 10, 15 people? Yeah, dude, sure. So, okay, it's like 340 people. Okay, that's another new challenge here. And I can still remember this guy standing at the back of the room, sweating bullets. I mean, he was like Richard Nixon sweating, sweating bullets, and coming up to the front and standing up on that podium right here and, you know, just like frozen. He was so freaking nervous and just standing here and telling everybody just what I told you. And it was so endearing. I wanted to kiss this guy. He was just so, so sweet. And he did that for 3 semesters in my class, and then he moved on and got a faculty position somewhere else. This is huge. Oh, my God. The difference that made in this guy's life, this is architectural determinism. This is the power that that physical environment at Banker House had to help him learn to be a mature, sophisticated human being and to help him remedy some issues he had in his own personality. Now, the building is so shaped by that. On the south side, in the entire building, every room, every dormitory room has a window for each person. So a single has one window, a double has 2 windows, a triple has 3 windows. And each person has their desk beneath that window. They get the beautiful natural light on their work surface. It also is kind of emblematic of this is a collection of individual human beings. Then you read the stack of those lounges that we were looking at, the largest lounge on each floor, and then the bathrooms and the windows, everything about the building is expressive of what is the function. Those special rooms for the living room, dining room, the relationship between the dining room and the living room. It is really thinking through lifestyle that is shaping this building. And it's an incredibly sophisticated version of it. It has been sitting there serving MIT students since 1949. Pretty amazing. Now, just down the way from Banker House, this is actually Banker House, the tail end of it right there. Just down the way from Banker House is another dormitory that was done in 1975 by another very good architect, José Luis Sert. And actually, it's not so different from one of those rejected parties or little diagrams that Aalto had. But it is meant to accommodate a different lifestyle. In 1975, they said, we don't want to duplicate Banker House. We want to know what are some lifestyles that maybe aren't accommodated as well in Banker House, and what are other alternatives? So this one is really a collection of 6 small houses, each of them with 60 people. There's one of them that's French house, one's this German house. They have kind of themes to them. You don't eat in a big central dining hall here. Some people, that's a turnoff to them. And so you actually can prepare your own meals. They're little kitchenettes, and the little kitchenettes are then grouped together in a way so that when you cook, you're not then taking it back to your room and eating on your desk like a super nerd. But instead, these little kitchenettes are grouped together, and there's a little common area for the people in your 60-unit portion of the building to eat. And then all of those have other, you know, ping-pong tables and TV rooms and all of those on the lower floors of each of those 6 buildings. And then those social rooms lead on to a kind of concourse that takes you down to a dining room if you did want to use the dining room in the adjacent dorm. You'd go down there, or to all these courtyards and outdoor spaces in between as well. Then up on the upper floors are the rooms and the bathrooms, and they're grouped in little suites of 6 or 8 like this. Each house has a south view. Each house has a north view. Clever, interesting way of handling that. But it's a completely different lifestyle than in Banker House. Just to say, never is one solution universally right. But the possibilities, it just is on Twitter card questions, you see the range of responses we get from you guys. This is just saying they need a range of housing options at MIT. And then these little social courtyards where people are spilling out and having their social life. So this is all about friendship formation, community building. But there are other issues also that architecture can affect quite fundamentally. This is really an amazingly powerful deterministic architectural environment designed by Le Corbusier. This is La Tourette Monastery just outside of Lyon in France. This was an experiment. It's built for the Dominican order of Catholic priests. The Dominicans in general are urban priests and they are in cities. But they were experimenting with having a cloistered group of priests. Being cloistered means that you separate yourself from society. You have your full communion with God. You are not trying to be a part of a community on earth. You're trying to connect to God. So the life is meant to be very solitary. It's meant to be very Spartan. You're supposed to live in a spiritual world oriented to God. So this was an experiment in the Dominican order. They put it out in the countryside, isolated, all by itself. And they asked Le Corbusier to make an environment that would help these priests become cloistered monks. So uphill, it's a kind of two-story building. The hill slides down. It becomes a taller building on the other side. The whole building is lifted off the ground. So it actually doesn't touch the ground. It says quite overtly, separated from the world around. It's beautiful countryside around, but there really is very little connection to that countryside. Even this chapel set up. There really are no visitors that are allowed, or originally as it was operated. No visitors could come in here except you could go into one of these little private conference rooms, and you could see somebody who was a monk in this order. But there, nobody from outside was allowed in. Nobody from inside was allowed out. They were cloistered. They were there. Generally, there's a huge chapel where the services were held, and then there were these little cells, all these little long, skinny rooms around a corridor on two floors. And those rooms are, if I stretch my arms out like that, I can touch both walls in that room. They're very narrow and very long. It's just room for a tiny little place. I wouldn't even call it a closet. It's a place to hang your cassock. There's a little sink. There is a bed, a long single bed. And then there's a desk and there's a window. And that's this long, thin room, and each monk would have that room. And they would spend many, many hours in that room just thinking, contemplating, writing, reading, communing with God. And then there is a corridor that would take them around to the rest of the building. On the lower floors, there are things like the refectory where they would eat and a library where they could study, some other common uses. There was a point at which they loosened their rules a little bit. And because it was an experiment. And I happened to visit the building just at the point when they were loosening their rules. So two friends and I were visiting there. We got there kind of late one evening, knocked on the door, said, we'd like to be able to just wander around and see the building from the outside. We understand you can't go in and all that. So they said, well, yeah, that'd be okay, but don't do it now. It's late in the day. Come back tomorrow. So we said, okay, is there some place we could stay around here? They're like, no, we're out in the middle of nowhere. There's no place to stay around here. And so we're trying to figure out what we're going to do. And finally this guy says, okay, look, I got a few extra rooms. You guys just come and spend the night here. So it's basically all these monks and the three of us there for the night. And so we get one of those little cells. And we went to dinner in the refectory, and the dinner, you don't talk. No one says anything because they're not communicating with each other. They're communicating with God. So it's really spooky to sit in a room with, you know, 100 other people and no one says anything. You just hear the silverware clanking. Otherwise, it's dead silent. And then we went to them saying their mass in the evening in the chapel. Incredibly moving experience there. So this is what this place is like. Number one, it is extremely Spartan. It's all made out of concrete. It's very, very harsh environment. This is like a monk wearing a hair shirt. You know, it's not about comfort. It's, in fact, overtly about discomfort. You are not meant to be enjoying the pleasures of the world. You're not supposed to be thinking about the world at all. You're thinking about God. You're thinking about spiritual, heavenly things. So the entire environment is very, very harsh and kind of alienated. This is the courtyard, but unlike some courtyards in monasteries where it's lush and green in a garden, completely the opposite. There's no ground here. The ground tumbles down, but the building is completely separated from it. There is a place to circumambulate because that's part of the ritual of walking and thinking. And so you can circumambulate around the whole thing on the roof here, but there is a wall high enough that you actually can't see out. So you're walking between two walls to get your daily walk. But it's too beautiful. The countryside's gorgeous. You're not meant to enjoy that countryside. It's not about pleasures of the world. So you're very, very isolated. That on the left is one of those corridors that leads to all those cells on the side there. That window, there's a very, very low ceiling. That window is right here for me. So you just barely can't see out. It's not meant to be for seeing out. It lets some light in, but it's not for seeing out. It's a little like gun turret window. And then at the end of the hall down here, there's a window, but it's got a concrete baffle on the outside, so we actually can't see out that one either. The concrete baffle bounces light into it, but doesn't let you see out. The floor here is covered in a very heavily padded linoleum, so when you walk on it, it makes no sound. The idea is that you're not here. You're invisible. And so you make no impact on the environment when you walk. Also, if your feet click, it might disturb someone who was contemplating or thinking in the room adjacent to it. It's a really strange way of almost not making you present in the world until you get to the chapel. And the chapel is just the opposite. It's bright colors. It's light bouncing off the colors, dramatic ways. It's incredible acoustics so that you're not only there, you're super there. You can almost hear yourself breathe. And when the monks are chanting, oh my God, it's the sound of the heavens. It's huge and it's big and it's reverberant. So it's just the opposite. When you're in God's space, then you're alive. Then, you know, you become present in this kind of spiritual world. And it's all about them saying the Mass. And the individual priest would say the Mass over and over and over and over. And by that ritual, make this contact with God. The building is there to shape not just one's lack of community, but also one's psyche, your feelings, your emotions. And that's another kind of architectural determinism, the ability of the physical environment to actually encourage certain emotions. I think if you lived in La Tourette Monastery in the way it was designed for 5 years, you would freaking become another person. A really other person from who you are now. That's the power of these environments. Okay, so this is the Twitter card question today. I want you to try to think of some environment that you've experienced that might have shaped your behavior. Was it how your bedroom was related to your brothers and sisters' bedroom in your home. Was it something in the school you went to? Was it maybe something in your freshman dormitory here at UT? Can you think of some physical environment that might have had an impact or shaped your behavior in some tiny way or some larger way that you can explain in a very short description?